League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Warning, this podcast contains explicit language, but we're talking about the Bible in it, so what the fuck did you expect?
Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by Chlorthodox Bleach, proven to whiten fabrics better than a Renaissance painter whitens a Middle Eastern messiah. Chlorthodox Bleach, like Christianity, is relatively safe for coloreds, but it's really made for whites. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
You think I'm sacrilegious because I said Jesus smelled bad? No, he was a man. He had bone, muscle, and sinew in those arms. You think his biceps weren't big, bulging biceps? Thin waist, strong shoulders from lifting?
Hello, I'm the anonymous Dr. Steve, regular contributor to the Times Literary Supplement of skeptical podcast Skepticule, and I'm constantly arguing for skeptical and philosophical humility, always wanting to be cautious and to bear in mind we might be wrong, the other argument might be right, we might be in the Matrix, we must be reflexive and constantly doubt our own arguments. But for fuck's sake, really? Really? Of course we evolved from filthy monkey men. Jesus! Here is The Scathing Atheist.
It's Thursday.
It's November 21st.
And non sequiturs are all about inflection.
I'm No Illusions.
I'm Heath Enright.
And from America's glitterous New York, New York, this is The Scathing Atheist.
On this week's episode, we'll point out that Christians are really just praying to Jew God in beta testing.
George W. Bush will prove that he still got it.
And Lucinda will join us to learn that 2 Samuel is fun, like a clumsy colonoscopy from a polydactyl giant.
But first, the diatribe. Everywhere I go, I'm haunted by the Goliath incisors and immaculate hairpiece of Joel Osteen. Every time I check our ranks on iTunes, which I probably do more often than is psychologically healthy, I see that preposterous oral contortion he calls a smile. It's always sitting there at the number one spot, beaming about his supremacy. He does the same thing on Stitcher, that asshole. And now he's showing up on my morning commute as well. He's got a new book out, and every third subway train I step into has an ad for it. It's yet another in his 12,000-part series about telling you whatever the fuck you want to hear as long as you're willing to pay him to say it. So the tagline on the ad is this brilliantly paradoxical sentence that perfectly encapsulates Osteen's particular brand of bullshit. Below his dentally arduous visage, it reads, "God doesn't want you to live an average life." Now think about that for a second. This is an ad. It's not like he's writing to, like, one person in particular. It's being told to everyone. So if Osteen's right and God doesn't want everyone to have an average life, he probably shouldn't have set up the law of averages to mathematically guarantee that they will. But that's the beauty of this whole prosperity gospel bullshit. It doesn't have to make sense. God wants you to be rich. Sure, that's why Jesus was all about investment advice and streamlining supply chains and stuff. God wants you to be rich. That's why he put you in a country where the income disparity makes some food chain seem equitable. God wants you to be rich, so he built you with a brain stupid enough to plop down $15 on the hardcover version of Joel Osteen cramming the word Jesus into a generic self-help seminar. And there, in a nutshell, is my biggest problem with religion. Here's this used dental floss salesman spouting on about Deepak-level bullshit, but it's okay because he sprinkles in some gods and a few Jesuses, and he does it with an accent that screams for banjo accompaniment. Therefore, it's Christian, and Christians will buy it. And it's not like Jesus is ever going to show up and contradict him or anything. It doesn't even matter that the core of Osteen's message is precisely antipodal to the core tenet of Christianity. It doesn't matter that he can't even assemble a one-sentence blurb about his book without working in an accidental oxymoron. It doesn't matter that the message makes The Secret look substantive. You like being rich, don't you? You like Jesus, don't you? Well, then buy this book, damn it. According to the ad copy, Osteen's new book will help you, quote, improve relationships, increase productivity, accomplish your dreams, and believe bigger. Yes, believe bigger. That's so stupid there should be a GNC supplement for it. Believe bigger? Gee, that's a hell of a deal, Joel, but do you have something in there that could help me run in tune? Maybe a section on how to jump darkly or masturbate opaquely. What the fuck does that even mean? But it doesn't have to mean anything because he's selling it to Christians. They've had their innate ability to recognize contradiction and bullshit beat out of them for decades. All you have to do is use a trigger word like Jesus, and they're hardwired to shut down the critical parts of their brain. Believe bigger? Sure, that makes sense from a spatial and or metaphorical perspective. Why not? The guy did say Jesus 9 times in 4 sentences, and he does a really good job making the word Lord multisyllabic, so clearly he knows what he's talking about. God wants me to be rich. Sure, I guess he could have given me wealthy parents or the Powerball numbers, but why bother going to all that trouble when he could just as easily stick all the secrets to happiness, fulfillment, and large beliefs in 22-point type, a 5th-grade reading level, and 5 easy steps? So run out and grab a copy today, boys and girls, and never forget, God wants everybody to be above average.
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is semi-professional devil's advocate Heath Enright. Heath, are you ready to publicly champion the angel of darkness?
Sure, I've always said some of my best friends are dark, so...
In our lead story tonight, it would seem that the Vatican has refused a deal they couldn't refuse. Italian organized crime experts warn that Pope Frank Corleone's attempt to reform the notoriously corrupt Vatican Bank might have put him at risk for waking up with an alpaca's head under his blanket.
I'm not too surprised. Dudes get whacked and rubbed out at the Vatican all the time. It's pretty standard.
Reverend Federico Lombardi, a spokesman for the Vatican, downplayed the reported threat, saying, quote, "The Holy See is not at all worried, and at this point we're kind of hoping somebody offs that fucker so we don't have to keep retracting his ad-libs."
Who would have ever guessed that an extremely opaque, corrupt bank full of Nazi plunder money and a bullshit pseudo-nation built into Rome. Who would have ever guessed they'd be laundering money for the mob? That's such a shocker.
Italian prosecutor and mafia expert Nicola Grattieri admits that he doesn't have any specific information about a plot against Pope Franks for playing, but he added, quote, "The last two popes didn't ride around in a bulletproof condom for aesthetics, guys."
And in B headline news, the militant rebel group in Syria known as the Islamic State of Iraq and All Sham, a.k.a. ISIS, put out a heartfelt apology after accidentally decapitating fellow extremist Mohamed Fares, who, according to local custom, should have really been guillotined by a rival group. So, that was awkward. Diplomats are imploring Syrian rebel groups to put their heads together in a large pile and come up with a peaceful solution to this problem.
Yeah, you guys are giving machete-wielding Muslim terrorists a bad name here.
When asked about the facectomy faux pas, ISIS may or may not have released the following statement. Quote, "Look, we got served by the People's Front of Judea on YouTube, and we were all scrambling to get a jihad response video in the can. Had we known he was such an accomplished murderer of slightly different Muslims, this never would have happened, guys."
You know, but I like this story because it kind of bucks the stereotype. You know, just when you thought that all Muslims do is kill people with slightly different religious beliefs than them, they go and kill somebody with the exact same religious beliefs
as them.
That is what
I thought.
That isn't a woman. It's just, it's empowering for them.
Yeah, it's a refreshing thing here. I like this story, too. It makes me feel like less of a bigot during my vigilante subway security sweeps. So, you know, it's a nice thing there. Apparently, Muslim extremists all look the same. Even to other Muslim extremists, so I don't feel guilty anymore.
And in Habitat for Humanity news tonight, ex-president Alfred E. Newman clone and miserable fucking idiot George W. Bush is under fire for speaking at a controversial Jews for Jesus fundraiser that seeks money to bring about the apocalypse by talking Jews out of the Judaism thing.
Why weren't we invited to that?
Right?
Our grossly offensive yet strangely appealing brand of humor begrudgingly devangelizes thousands of Jews every week, I'm pretty sure.
Good point.
If there's a second coming, it's pretty much all us.
Hells yeah.
Damn right.
A spokesman for the National Embarrassment defended Bush's appearance by arguing that, quote, "Of all the fucked up shit this dude has done and all the stupid decisions, you're going to get your panties in a twist because he finally came clean about hating Jews? Fuck off.
And despite his well-documented neural deficiencies, I'm like 90% sure he did make the following statement at the event. You guys know Jesus' old saying, right? Crucify me once, shame on me. Crucify me twice. No, I'll come back and... Well, you're not going to crucify me again. That ain't happening. And from the persecution by bookstore taxonomy file, Christians are outraged after being forced to push their pallet truck all the way to the fiction section of Costco just to buy 10,000 Bibles shrink-wrapped on a big piece of wood. California pastor Caleb Kaltenbach, whose name sadly lacks any overt genital references, recently discovered that a local Costco put a fiction label on the fantastical allegory book that defines his life.
Kaltenbach.
Colton. Indeed, after numerous complaints similar to that one from adult people who don't know what fiction means, Costco has diplomatically agreed to open a, quote, factually impaired nonfiction section or a, quote, liography section to hold religious propaganda books in a properly named area.
All right, so I'm going to come to Costco's defense here because before I read this article, I didn't know religious people could read either. So. And in the supplest of supplication news tonight, Illinois bishop and person who shouldn't be mixed with carbonated beverages, Thomas Paprocki, plans to hold an exorcism in, quote, reparation for the sin of same-sex marriage.
Okay. I mean, I guess this is a smart move. It's going to shut down the earthquakes and typhoons for a little bit. You're welcome, Philippines. Also, I'm pretty sure there's a joke in here about gay ghost demons and crossing the streams with the Ghostbusters with the trap.
All right, yeah, yeah. Okay, so while you're working that one out, I'll get back to the story. Paprocki justified his belief that gay marriage is inspired by Lucifer by pointing out that back when Pope Fran Tarkenton was still just Cardinal George Berger Google, he said as much. When Argentina legalized gay marriage, the then Archbishop called it, quote, a move of the father of lies who wishes to confuse and deceive the children of God, end quote, which is clearly either a reference to the devil or then Supreme Pontificate Pope Benedictus.
How do exorcisms work again, by the way? I forget from science class. Will the gay... married couples stop being gay or stop being married? Oh. Or will one of them, like, grow a dick or, like, lose a dick or something? How does it?
Yes.
Okay.
The exorcism is actually scheduled to take place while we're recording tonight. So if by the time you hear this, there are still fags, Paprocki will have proven that at least Catholic God is verifiably false.
Gays are the Gozarian.
Nice.
Good
nice.
Evening.
Well done, sir.
And from the Irish comedian tells offensive joke about Muslims file. Why the fuck is anyone ever surprised about the contents of this file? Conan O'Brien recently tweeted, quote, Marvel Comics is introducing a new Muslim female superhero. She has so many more special powers than her husband's other wives, end quote. Now, despite being hilarious and therefore exempt from bigotry charges, there were many angry responses. And Conan deleted the tweet like a pussy.
Well, now, in his defense, he could have been trying to protect his streak for the longest a person's ever been considered a comedian without actually being funny.
He did have that going. One such angry response, by the way, said, quote, real classy bigotry, Conan O'Brien. Did you enjoy having a laugh at the expense of the marginalized? Yes! Conan O'Brien and all other comedians, they tell jokes, and we all have a laugh at the expense of the marginalized. That's jokes. That's what humor is. And it's not like he made an offensive list of possible names for
I'm pretty sure that's a cue to put 30 seconds on the clock.
Yes, it is.
All right, so Muslim superheroines, go.
Excellent. By the way, before we start officially moving the clock, I did some research on this, and there does exist a Pakistaname superheroine called, no bullshit, the Burqa Avenger. But we're going to make up our own here.
All right.
I'm going to start with Silk Scarf Spectre.
All right, how about Burkat Woman? No, okay, that sucks.
Burkat.
Fat Wonder Woman? Like, I know that's not very good, but the Brown Widow is racist, so I'm trying not to use that one.
That is racist. I mean, not all Muslim women were widowed by a suicide bomber. That's not fair. the Black Tar Heroine. That's something with their opium.
Oh, how about Hummistique?
They do eat hummus. The almost invisible woman, like just a floating eye rectangle is all you get.
I was going to say the wishes she was invisible woman.
I'm sure she does. She-Ramadan. She-Ramadan? She-Ramadan? The She-Hottest. The She-Hottest, that's it.
All right. Oh, how about a whole team of superwomen? We could call them the Fantastic 72.
Shit, yeah. The Little Lebowski virgin achievers, the heaven groupies, the Taliban dates. Love them.
Oh, damn. I hate to close things out so close to a fatwa, but we're running out of time for a headline. So, Heath, thanks as always.
Masayonara, bitches.
And when we come back, Lucinda will join us in discovering that the 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel division had nothing to do with the bathroom codes. To Samuel, well, damn, you'll forgive me for saying I'm starting to like all the raping and slaying. It's not that the Bible has sapped all my ethics, and it's not that I'm a big fan of historical epics. It's just better than all the begats and the praying. Don't get me wrong, it's too long, and the story's a mess, and there's a huge literary mistake to address. A new character appears every sentence or two, which makes keeping track of them miserably tricky to do, but I suppose I can try nonetheless. To start it all, there was Saul, who was king but got killed, then there's David, whose promise from God was fulfilled, there's Ahinoam and Abby, David's first wives, and Ishbael, son of Saul, whose reign he revives, with Abner, a warrior respected and skilled. Joab's the commander of David's armed forces, his brother Asahel runs as fast as the horses, but he's slowed down when Abner puts a spear through his gut, so Joab snuffs him out like a cigarette butt against David's order, according to dubious sources. Bana and Rechab are Ishbael's remaining commanders, but they kill their own king and go to David to pander, so with Saul's house destroyed, he goes after the chicks, like Michal, who he purchased with Philistine dicks and wants back, though it's clear he can't stand her. King David was fertile, with a dick never limp, and he had more chicks to fuck than a Manhattan pimp, so he had children a lot. First Amnon, then Shelaab, Absalom, Adonijah, Shephatiah, and Ithraim, and oh yeah, he took care of Mephibosheth the Gimp. Tamar was a hottie, and Amnon wanted to fist her, so he told his friend Jonadab he couldn't resist her. Jonadab says rape her, so Amnon acts like he's sick. When she bends over to help, he just whips out his dick, then he fucks her, then boots her, and oh yeah, she's his sister. Ugh. Then there's Bathsheba. Tamar was hot, but she's hotter, and with David for a sponsor, she's wearing nothing but water, so he disregards the fact that she's menstruating and married, as salami was hard and it had to be buried, and so did Uriah, her husband, who David had slaughtered. King Haram builds King David's stately abodes. Nathan the seer foretells and forebodes. Hanun the Ammonite mistreats King David's men. Shammai tosses rocks at the king now and then, and Uzzah puts a hand on the ark and explodes. Sheba is mutinous. Ahithophel is unwise. Amasa brings about Sheba's demise. Eleazar, Shamash, and Josheb-Bashabeth are ferocious, impetuant merchants of death. And oh yeah, there's Solomon, who has yet to arise. From Abiathar the priest to Ziba, servant of Saul, through the dozens of characters I don't even recall, there's no shortage within of unpronounceable names, so when you think about it, it's really kind of a shame that they named the book after someone who isn't in it at all.
The Holy Babel.
For the love of our listeners, we suffered through 2 Samuel this week. This book has all the literary intrigue of a high school newspaper and as many characters as a high school yearbook, and yet still, somehow, we got all the way through it.
I used cocaine. Good for awful books, plus it helps you stay motivated to buy more cocaine later that day.
Right.
And the third digit in my bank account was getting really unmanageable. I could quit reading the Bible whenever I want, is what I'm saying.
And, of course, joining us in this misguided adventure once again is my lovely wife, Lucinda. Lucinda, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, despite the circumstances, and I think Heath should have shared the cocaine.
All right, so 2 Samuel starts off exactly where 1 Samuel leaves off. So, Lucinda, can you set the stage for us?
Sure. When last we saw our intrepid hero, David, he was off kicking Amalekite ass, rescuing kidnapped people, and being elsewhere while Israel gets wasted by the Philistines.
So chapter 1 of 2 Samuel starts with some random guy showing up and telling David that Jonathan and Saul fell in battle and that, upon request, he finished Saul off, so David kills him.
That's my gay lover and his dad, my other gay lover you're talking about, asshole. Nobody finishes off Saul better than me.
Oh, well done.
Thank you.
So with Saul dead, the whole kingdom goes to shit. David's declared king of Judah. Ishbael becomes king of not Judah. Then, of course, they start killing each other.
So, how are we going to settle this? We can't have people fighting over this shitty desert for the next 5,000 years. what if we take 10 of my guys and 10 of your guys, they all stab each other at the same time, and we just see what happens?
That's a terrible idea. Make it 12 guys each, and you got yourself a deal.
Much more reasonable.
And in chapter 3, we learn that David definitely didn't kill Abner, son of Ner, even though he was around when it happened. And he benefited greatly from it and could have done it. He definitely didn't do it.
Who keeps asking about whether he killed him? Right, it wasn't David. It was his general, Joab. And generals don't just kill people on command for you.
No,
so.
Of course not. Then we learn in chapter 4 that he also didn't kill Ishbael either.
Certainly.
Hell, he killed him even less than he killed Abner.
So after the coincidental and definitely not premeditated by David murders of his two rivals to the throne, he becomes king of Israel.
And he fucks a lot. I mean, he's got wives, concubines, and other dudes' wives.
And then we get a whole chapter talking about the Bring Me the Ark parade, which apparently ends in a tent where David rocks out with his cock out, which pisses off his first wife.
You'll remember her from 1 Samuel, where he traded her straight up for a bag of dicks.
Right, right. The dick bag trade.
And then God promises that David's line will rule Israel forever.
Yeah, how's that working out?
David was part Palestinian, right?
And then he kicks ass, kills people, subdues land, and steals gold.
Apparently he won the loyalty of the Moabites by only murdering 2/3 of them. All right, so who wants to play a really fun game? Everybody look to your left, and now to your right. I'm going to murder you and one of those other two guys you just looked at. Or both of them, and you're my slave.
Then David starts feeling guilty for definitely not killing Jonathan, so he decides to take in his crippled grandson.
Then the Ammonites piss him off by forcibly shaving his envoys, so he kicks ass some more and kills a lot more people.
And since 2 Samuel is the model for all future latently homoerotic fraternity pledge hazing, they shave half their beard and make them wear assless pants.
Right.
Yet, despite this biblical mandate, Mitt Romney was chastised when he did the same thing to a gay at his high school.
Good point. And then, holy shit, just when you thought David could do no wrong, we meet Bathsheba. David's just minding his own business, beating off on his porch one day when he sees this hot chick bathing.
I knew it was going to pay off to put up that bucket of sudsy sponges and that dirty car right here on the palace porch. Give her dad these 50 shekels, you know, just in case, and bring her to me.
So what do you do, right? I mean, she's married, so he can't just take her as his wife. Unless, of course, she's suddenly widowed.
Accident.
So he goes ahead and sees to that.
And apparently that was a bridge too far, and God decides to enact some holy retribution on David for that one.
Or more accurately, on David's wives.
Right.
Who he sentences to be publicly fucked by his neighbors and his son, who God then kills with a horrible illness.
Yeah, that ought to show him.
And since God doesn't exist, David blatantly chose to have her gang-raped himself. Unless, of course, this book isn't meant to be taken literally, in which case the gang-rape must be a metaphor for something good and holy.
And then Amnon teaches us all how to properly rape your sister, just in case you're wondering.
That's right. So I really want to fuck my sister, but she's not as rednecky as I hoped. Do we have a sister-fucking-guy on staff? Well, Jonadab didn't specialize in that, but he's pretty clever. I talked to Jonadab.
So Jonadab says, have you tried luring her to your house and raping her?
Yeah. Just tell her you want to eat freshly baked bread directly from her hand.
Right?
That way it won't be suspicious.
The fuck is he, a bird? But apparently his brother Absalom, or Mom-Nom, whatever his name is, wasn't too happy about it, so he ordered his servants to kill him, and then he fled to Geshur.
Right, so David half-ass forgives Absalom, and that's not enough, so Absalom sets Joab's field on fire in some kind of tantrum.
He didn't respond to, like, 2 of his texts. It was
a big deal.
And then a surprise twist, it turns out that Absalom, the fratricidal arsonist, is actually a bad guy. You always know the antagonist by the name. You've never met a Jew named Absalom. Right. That's David's.
Right.
Nobody's met an Absalom, anyone with an ish dash at the beginning of the name. Any Jews you've met before.
So then he starts undermining his dad and sets himself up as king.
Then David tucks his tail between his legs and takes to the woods. Along the way, people start throwing rocks at him and shit for being a slut.
And then David sends Hushai the Archite to fuck up the council of Ahithophel, who then advises Absalom to bang his father's concubines as publicly as possible.
I knew that coming was coming.
I knew Caesar had it wrong. It's Vidi Vici Veni. I saw, I conquered, I came. Which it's an important morality lesson here, and I can see why they kept it in the book. I mean, how else does a guy know which whores to fuck during a Jew d'etat following the rape of his sister by a half-brother?
Right.
And where does God want me to fuck them? Publicly? Privately? This is more than is made clear.
In a beetle.
But the problem is he's taking advice from Ahithophel when he should have been listening to Akbar, because as we learn in chapter 18, it's a trap.
David's army surrounds Absalom's army, and once again, we find David most definitely not killing his enemy.
Did you kill your son with spears and hang him from a tree? No!
No, no,
no, no. A bit.
Certainly.
A bit. I did do the spears. What had happened is, well, on the average, what I'm saying is Absalom, on the average day, walks around with about 100 shekels worth or 2 rapings worth of beautiful, nappy Jufro on his head. As he often did, he was riding an ass, and his hair got caught, and then he got speared. But it was by the guy I keep pardoning and reappointing general after murdering my rivals without my permission. So I had really nothing to do with it.
But they can't get all the way to Jerusalem even before there's another coup attempt.
Right. The non-Judean Israelites get a bad case of middle child syndrome, so they rally under Sheba and march off to start their own promised land.
I'm taking my ball and going home.
And just in case you were wondering what happened to the 10 prostitutes David left in Jerusalem to be pillaged by Absalom's army, they're still there, but David absolutely did not fuck them again when he got back. Like, to be clear about that. He was nice enough, though, to put them up in a studio apartment for used whore widows and get them a reality show called Real Housewives of Ancient Jerusalem, I believe.
Then we get a famine, and David's like, hey, God, what's with all this starving and shit? And God says, yeah, you know, Saul did try to kill the Gibeonites, so everyone has to starve unless you impale 7 of his descendants on a hillside.
So Jesus stole that trick from Saul's grandkids?
Yeah.
Is that what we're saying?
Apparently. And because this book was directed by Michael Bay, it ends in an action beat, and they go around killing giants.
Giants.
Only Michael Bay could come up with the idea for the final fight. David's nephew rubs polydactyl cream on his sword and kills the 12-fingered Amish giant despite his seemingly unsurmountable 20% advantage in grip and simple arithmetic. Unbelievable.
And then we meet the Hebrew special ops guys. This whole chapter is just a list of Jewish ass kickers that reads like Noah's thanking the donors at the end of the show.
Oh, I am totally using that this week.
Good stuff.
And then David takes a census, and apparently God gets as pissed off about those as Tea Party libertarians, so he plagues the nation for 3 days and kills 70,000 fucking people.
Tread on me and count stuff. So God says, it's like your fucking drunk friend when you're in college, I give you 3 choices. Would you rather 70,000 Jews get killed by plague over the course of the next 3 days,
or
you're forced to wear mittens for 3 months straight, or you almost sneeze but lose it once a day for 3 years. So David just did the census, and 70,000 is probably pretty minor, so plague it was.
Yeah, not exactly a climactic ending. But
hey, look, books of the Bible are like masturbation, not sex. It's climactic enough if it's over. So that does it for 2 Samuel. The Holy Babel will be back in episode 43 with 1 Kings. Heath, Lucinda, thanks again.
Libel, babble, libel, babble, rabble, rabble, rabble.
Penis.
What?
That one's for Duncan on Twitter.
Okay, all right. You're right. In honor of my friend Luke, on whose birthday we're recording this episode and who was a huge part of the inspiration that eventually became this show, I'll be rendering the outro tonight by request in third person biblical. And behold, Noah did earn favor in the eyes of the people, and the spaghetti monster was with him, and so he went to the people, and he gathered them together, and he spoke unto them, but then he reached the end of the show. And the people lamented, for there was no more blasphemy, but then they learned that there was more blasphemy, and they rejoiced. For Noah had spoken before to Jake of the house of Far and the house of Wharton on the Imaginary Friends show, and all the words that he spake could be found by people on episode 159 of that show. And they learned, too, that Noah had also made a cameo on The Herd Mentality with Adam Reeks, son of Brian, son of Sidney, son of William, and that he could be heard there, too, on episode 29 of that fine program of the Australiates. And the people did call out for Heath the heathen, and they did heap adoration upon him, as well they should. And they did call out for Lucinda, the concubine of Noah, whom they loved, and they did heap adoration upon her as well. And they did call out for the anonymous Dr. Steve, regular contributor to the Skeptical podcast and Vegas favorite for the best Farnsworth quote of all fucking time. And they should probably heap adoration on him as well, and if they were so inclined, they would find a convenient link on the show notes for this episode at thescathingatheist.com. And Noah called out to the people and said to them, follow me on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and stuff. And the people did follow him. And then he called from all the people six that were the best of all of them. And he said, Deb, who is a friend of the woodland animals, come forward. And Deb came forward. And he said, Lindsay, who defeated 10,000 Philistines at once with an ink pen and chapstick, come forward. Willie, upon whose house birds fear to shit, for he is so great. Jeffrey, who is long of shaft and brass of ball. Morton, whose wisdom is greater still than 10 men, 10 women, and 3 hermaphrodites. And Lee, whose enemies flee before his name, which is rough on them because Lee is a very common syllable. All of you come forth. And Deb and Lindsay and Willie and Jeffrey and Morton and Lee did come forth, and Noah spoke unto them, saying, all those who hear my words are great, but you are greater still, for you have sacrificed your hard-earned shekel upon the altar of our PayPal account, thus earning great favor such that your names will be forever remembered, and that the spaghetti monster will look favorably upon your houses for many generations. And then Noah figured the biblical thing was pretty much played out, so he just said, if you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find all the contact info on the contact page at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. And then David farts. And they didn't record. I'm sure he did at some point, but they didn't record that in the Bible.
Unfortunately.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there. We'll be right back.